Before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. If you're studying for the Series 24, they have a full course with adaptive quizzes, smart flashcards, and, unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check them out at certfuel.com. All right, let's get right into it. Today, we're looking at a regulatory landscape that is just completely murky for a lot of test takers.
Oh, absolutely murky.
Yeah, we are going to follow a single disastrous options trade from the exact moment a client sends an angry tweet all the way to a, well, basically a secret internal court system where the penalty for ignoring just a single piece of mail is losing your entire career forever.
It is a wild ride.
Yeah.
And for anyone taking the Series 24 exam, this exact life cycle of a dispute is where a lot of candidates just get utterly lost in the weeds.
Yeah.
They tend to memorize isolated rules, but they don't see the whole ecosystem.
Right, because it just feels like a random soup of deadlines and dollar amounts.
Feels
So to anchor this, I really want to use a concrete analogy. Let's say you make a terrible mistake and you get a DUI. And in the process of that, you crash your car into your neighbor's fence. You now have two completely different legal problems, right?
right. You have to go to criminal court to deal with the state trying to pull your driver's license. But you also have to go to civil court because your neighbor wants, say, $10,000 to fix their fence. Those are entirely parallel tracks.
Yeah.
The criminal judge doesn't care about the neighbor's fence, and the civil judge doesn't have the power to take your driver's license.
And that is exactly how the financial regulation system works. The exam is testing whether you can distinguish between regulatory discipline, which is, FINRA acting like the state, pulling your license to protect the public,
Right.
and private dispute resolution, which is just the neighbor trying to get the fence money back. They run at the same time, but they have completely different rule books.
It's a perfect framing. And to make these incredibly dense rule books actually stick in our brains today, we need a cast of characters to live through this nightmare.
We absolutely do. So, listener, meet our recurring cast. First, we have Broker Bob. Bob is a well-meaning but constantly blundering registered representative.
Poor Bob.
Yeah, poor Bob. Then we have customer Carl. Carl is a highly litigious, short-tempered client who is always looking for a reason to sue somebody. And finally, we have firm Fiona. She is the perpetually stressed OSJ manager. That's the Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction Manager. And she is desperately trying to keep Bob in compliance and keep the whole firm from being expelled.
The perfect trio to test every single limit of the FinTNR ecosystem.
I know, right? So let's set the scene. The dispute begins. Customer Carl loses a huge chunk of change on some highly aggressive options trades that Broker Bob
But
recommended.
of course he did.
Yeah, so Carl is furious. He's at home, fuming, and he fires off a ridiculously angry direct message on Twitter, directly tagging firm Fiona, complaining about Bob's exorbitant fees and just terrible advice. So if you're listening and taking the exam, what is your instinct here? Customer Carl sends a furious direct message on Twitter to firm Fiona complaining about Bob. Does a social media tweet actually count as a quote unquote written customer complaint that triggers all the regulatory rules? Think about it for a second.
Yeah, take a beat.
Okay, did you guess?
The answer is yes. It absolutely does. The format really doesn't matter as long as it is in writing. Emails, faxes, secure customer portal messages, text messages, and yes, even social media DMs all count as written complaints.
Oh, wow. But what if Carl was old school? Like, what if he called Fiona on the branch phone line and screamed at her for 45 minutes straight about Bob's terrible trades? Does that trigger the rule?
Surprisingly, no.
Wait, really?
Yeah, really. What does not count, at least for the strict FANDRO record-keeping rule, is an oral complaint. Even if he yells for an hour, an oral complaint is not a written customer complaint under this specific FANDRA rule. Now, firm Fiona might have her own internal company procedures to document angry phone calls,
Sure.
but from FANDRA's regulatory perspective, they only care about the paper trail. They regulate what they can read.
Okay, so Fiona gets this angry Twitter DM. She takes a screenshot. She has a written complaint. Now what? She has to put it in a file somewhere, right?
Right. Fiona has to keep these files at her Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction, her OSJ, or she needs to keep a separate record of the complaints with a really clear cross-reference to where they are actually stored electronically. Like they have to be readily accessible.
And I'd imagine that's because when FANRA examiners show up in their suits with their little clipboards, they don't want to go on a scavenger hunt through a messy filing cabinet.
Exactly. They want to see the complaint and right next to it, the action the firm took to resolve it, all in one neat package.
Okay, this feels like a trap, though. I'm looking at the timelines here. And I know the exam loves to test conflicting rules. If I recall correctly, the SEC Books and Records Rule says you have to retain customer complaints for 3 years.
Right.
But the FINRA's rule says you have to retain them for 4 years. So if I'm Fiona, who do I listen to? The SEC is the big boss, right?
They are the big boss, but this is a classic Series 24 trap. The golden rule of regulatory conflicts is this. When rules conflict, the longer, more stringent period controls. So firm Fiona must keep Carl's tweet for 4 years.
But why the discrepancy? Like, why does FINRA insist on 4 years when the SEC only wants three?
It comes down to the actual mechanics of the FINRA examination cycle. So FINRA conducts routine massive examinations of these branch offices on a 4-year cycle.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. If the retention period was only 3 years, a sneaky firm could theoretically purge all their dirty laundry and complaints in year three. Then when FINRA finally shows up in year four, the file cabinet is magically empty. Right. So to prevent that, Fiona extended their rule to 4 years to ensure the records actually survive until the next audit.
That makes total sense when you understand the mechanism.
Yeah.
4 years. Keep the tweet for 4 years. So Fiona puts the screenshot in her perfectly organized 4-year file, but filing it internally is one thing. When does she actually have to tell FINRA that Bob messed up?
So this brings us to reporting. And there are two main timelines you really have to drill into your head for the exam. There's the 30-day per event report, and then the 15th-day quarterly roll-up.
Okay.
Let's start with the immediate one, the 30-day triggers. Fiona has to promptly report to FINRA within 30 calendar days if she learns about certain high-priority catastrophic events.
Okay, so what counts as catastrophic? I assume we're talking about things like statutory disqualifications. And just to refresh my memory, statutory DQs, we're talking about things like Bob getting convicted of a felony or getting expelled from another securities exchange, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Criminal convictions for money-related crimes, expulsions, injunctions. If any of those happen, Fiona has 30 days to tell FINRA. She also has to report if the firm internally concludes that a significant rule violation occurred, or if another regulator takes action against Bob.
Okay.
But a huge area for the exam is the settlement thresholds.
Oh.
This is where it gets super tricky.
Oh, let's test this then. Listener, I want you to visualize this scenario. Customer Carl demands $50,000 from broker Bob because of those bad options trades. But he is exhausted. He just wants Carl to go away and stop tweeting at him. So Bob settles with Carl out of his own pocket for $14,000. Does Fiona have to file a 30-day per event report for that settlement? Think about it.
Give him a second.
Okay, did you figure it out?
No, she does not. The reporting threshold for a registered representative like Bob is triggered only if the claim is settled or adjudicated for over $15,000.
Oh.
If the lawsuit named firm Fiona's company itself, the threshold is over $25,000.
Wait, let me make sure I have this straight. Carl demanded 50 grand. The demand was massive. But because Bob wrote a check for exactly $14,000, it stays completely under the radar for the 30-day report.
That is correct.
Mm.
Notice what didn't matter in that equation. Carl's initial demand.
Right.
The demand size is utterly irrelevant for this specific role. Carl could have demanded $5 million. If Bob settles for $14,000, it does not cross the $15,000 threshold for a rep. The trigger is purely based on the settled or adjudicated amount.
That is such a good testable point. The demand doesn't matter, only the ink on the settlement check.
Exactly.
But hold on, there has to be an exception to this dollar amount rule, right? Like, some things are too big to ignore.
There is, and it's a massive one. It's the theft and forgery exception.
Okay, let's introduce a ridiculous hypothetical to make this stick. Let's say in that angry tweet, customer Carl didn't just complain about bad trades. What if Carl alleged that broker Bob straight up stole money from his options account to buy a bright yellow supercharged jet ski?
If Carl alleges theft, misappropriation of funds, or forgery, the dollar amount thresholds completely go out the window.
Seriously?
Seriously. If Fiona gets a written complaint alleging Bob stole money for a jet ski, she must report that to FINRA within 30 days. Period. It doesn't matter if the jet ski costs $500 or $50,000.
But wait. What if Fiona knows for a fact that Carl is lying? What if Bob is standing right in her office, showing her his bank statements, proving he didn't buy a jet ski, and that Carl is just a lunatic trying to extort them? Does she still have to report it?
Even then.
No way.
Yes. And it's vital to understand why. The reporting requirement is triggered by the receipt of the allegation, not by the firm's internal determination of its truth.
Oh, I see.
FINRA doesn't want branch managers acting as the judge and jury in secret. Fioran wants to know about theft allegations immediately so their own enforcement division can decide if it's credible. So you report it within 30 days, regardless of the amount, regardless of merit.
Wow. Okay, so we have the 30-day report for the big scary stuff. Theft, forgery, statutory DQs, and those specific settlements over $15,000 for reps or $25,000 for firms. What about the other report? The quarterly roll-up.
The quarterly statistical report is a different beast entirely.
Huh.
It is due by the 15th day of the month following the end of the calendar quarter. So for Q1, which ends March 31st, the report is due April 15th.
Right.
And this report covers all written customer complaints.
All of them. So if a complaint was already reported on the big, scary 30-day report, does it have to go on the quarterly report too? Like Carl's jet ski theft tweet. Does Fiona put it on both?
Yes. The jet ski theft goes on both.
Hmm.
Think about the purpose of each.
Okay.
The 30-day report is an immediate red flare sent up into the sky saying, hey, Finneray, we have a major emergency right now.
Yeah.
The quarterly report is more of a statistical dragnet. It's a spreadsheet that captures the total volume and type of complaints firm-wide, so Finner can look for macro trends across the industry.
Ah, so they can see if everyone is suddenly complaining about options everywhere.
Hmm.
Exactly. So if Carl just complained about high fees, that only goes on the quarterly report. But because he alleged theft, it triggers the immediate 30-day flare, and it gets tallied in the quarterly dragnet.
That makes perfect sense. Immediate flare versus statistical dragnet. I love that. So Fiona reported the jet ski theft on the 30-day flare. But Finera isn't just going to put that in a file cabinet and forget about it, right? What happens when Finera's enforcement division actually reads that report and decides they want answers from Bob?
This is where we shift from record keeping into active regulatory compulsion. Finera enforcement opens an investigation. They have the authority to compel Bob to provide written information, hand over his personal bank documents, or sit for what's called an OTR, an on-the-record interview.
And if you're Bob, sweating in that interview room, you might be thinking, hey, wait a minute, where are my constitutional rights? Where is my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent? Where is the police subpoena?
Right.
But Fander doesn't need a police subpoena, do they?
No, they don't. And here's the mechanism you really need to understand. FINRA is not the government.
Okay. They are not the FBI. They are a self-regulatory organization, an SRO. They are essentially a giant private club that runs the securities industry.
Oh, I get it. It's like signing up for a piece of software. When Bob got his license, he filed a Form U-4. That's his industry entrance ticket. And by signing that, he essentially clicked agree on a massive terms of service contract.
Exactly. It's a contractual obligation, not a constitutional one.
Yeah.
You agreed to cooperate with their investigations as a condition of keeping your license to sell securities.
Okay.
If you don't cooperate, you are in breach of that contract and they can kick you out of the club.
Okay, let's play this out. Bob panics. He realizes Fenra is looking into the jet ski money. He decides, you know what? I'm done with finance. This is way too stressful.
Mm.
He quits his job at Fiona's firm, moves to a beach in Mexico, and starts teaching surfing. Here is a question for the listener. 18 months after Bob quits the industry, Fenra tracks him down in Mexico and demands his bank records regarding the jet ski. Does he have to answer them?
Think carefully on this one.
Yeah, take a second. Does he have to answer?
Okay.
Yes, he absolutely does.
Oh, man.
FINRA retains jurisdiction over former associated persons for a full 2 years after their registration terminates. They have a 2-year jurisdictional tail.
2 years. But here's the exam trap. Let's call it out explicitly. Does the 2-year clock start from the date the alleged jet ski theft happened or some other date?
It starts from the termination registration, specifically the date his Form U-5 is filed.
And just to clarify, the Form U-5 is the industry exit ticket, right? The permanent record of why you left a firm.
Exactly. U-4 gets you in, U-5 gets you out.
Nice.
So, if the jet ski theft happened 3 years ago, but Bob just quit yesterday and Fiona filed his U-5 yesterday, FINRA still has him on the hook for 2 full years starting from yesterday. The date of the crime doesn't start the clock. The date of leaving the industry starts the clock.
Okay, let's inject a little danger here. What if Bob, sitting on his beach in Mexico, just decides to ignore Fanara's letters? He uses them as kindling for his beach bonfire. He ignores an information request for 90 days. What happens?
If he ignores them, he isn't just suspended. He is permanently barred from the securities industry.
Permanently barred. Your entire career is over forever just for ignoring a piece of mail for 3 months.
Yes. And it's crucial to understand why adjudicators treat this so harshly. Failure to respond to a FINRA request is a separate, standalone rule violation.
Oh, I see.
Even if Bob was totally innocent, Like, even if Carl bought the jet ski himself and expertly framed Bob, the act of ignoring Funera will result in a permanent bar.
Because the whole system collapses if people can just ignore the private club's investigators.
Exactly. The SRO system relies entirely on compulsory cooperation. If reps could just ignore letters without severe penalty, Funera would have absolutely no teeth. So the cover-up, or in this case the ignoring up, is treated as a fatal offense. Always cooperate and defend.
Wow. Always cooperate. So Bob comes back from Mexico because he doesn't want a permanent bar. Let's talk about the sanctions menu if he does cooperate, but they actually find him guilty. What can Funera do to you?
They have a whole menu of punishments. They can issue a censure, which is basically a formal public reprimand. They can levy a fine. They can order a suspension for a set number of months. They can issue a bar. And they can order restitution, forcing you to pay the money back.
Okay.
But there's a huge exam trap here regarding this specific terminology.
Yes, the vocabulary here is incredibly strict. Listeners, Funera distinguishes heavily between humans and companies. People, like individuals like Broker Bob, get barred, or their individual registration is revoked or canceled.
Right.
But firms, like firm Fiona's entire company, get expelled, or their membership is canceled.
Yeah.
Do not mix these up on the test. You cannot expel Broker Bob, and you cannot bar firm Fiona.
Right. Memorize those verbs. And when it comes to those fines on the menu, there's no statutory cap on Funera fines under this framework.
Wait, none?
None. They have sanction guidelines that recommend normal ranges for offenses. But an adjudicator can blow right past those guidelines if they find aggravating factors.
And what if Bob gets a massive fine, throws a tantrum, and says, I'm not paying it? Do they have to take him to court to collect?
No, they have a much faster mechanism. If a rep refuses to pay a levied fine, Funera can summarily suspend or cancel his registration with just 7 days written notice.
Mm-hmm.
No trial needed for the non-payment. 7 days notice, and your license is dead.
7 days. That is brutal. Now, while all this investigation and finding is happening behind closed doors, the public might be finding out. If Bob gets a Form U5 disclosure filed against him because of this jet ski mess, it goes public on the BrokerCheck website 3 business days after Funera processes it.
Which is terrifying for Bob because it gives him a very tiny window, just 3 business days, to file an updated Form U4 to add his own comments and tell his side of the story before every single one of his clients sees Carl's accusation online.
Okay, so Bob cooperates. He sits for the interview. He hands over his bank records. But enforcement doesn't buy his story. They think his bank records look suspicious, and they believe he really did steal the jet ski money. They file a formal complaint against him. This means we leave the investigation phase, and we officially enter Funera Court, formerly known as the Code of Procedure.
Right. The Code of Procedure is Funera's internal justice system. This is the mechanism for regulatory discipline. Enforcement has filed a complaint, and Bob has to file a written answer.
And if he doesn't?
If he ignores the complaint and doesn't show up, he loses by default, and all the terrible allegations are legally deemed admitted. But assuming he fights it, we go to an internal trial before a hearing panel.
Let's break down the judges on this hearing panel, because it's a very specific mix. It is not just one old judge with a gavel. It's a panel of 3 people, 1 hearing officer plus 2 industry panelists. Why this specific 1+2 setup?
It's designed to balance the legal needs with the practical realities of the market. The 1 hearing officer is a full-time Funera employee and a lawyer.
Okay.
Their job is to handle the procedural stuff. The rules of evidence, the legal motions, keeping the trial moving. But the 2 industry panelists are Bob's peers. They are other registered reps or compliance officers straight from the industry.
And the logic there is that a pure lawyer might not understand how a complex option strategy actually works in practice, right? Like, a lawyer might see a spread and think it's fraud when it's just a normal hedge.
Exactly. The peers know the market norms. They know what a normal trade ticket looks like. They know how a branch office actually operates day to day.
And the math of this panel is actually in Bob's favor, isn't it? Decisions are made by majority vote. So Bob only needs to convince 2 out of the 3 people on the panel to win. He just needs to get the 2 industry peers to side with him, and he wins, even if the Funera lawyer is convinced he's guilty.
That's the math. But let's say the peers don't buy it either. The panel finds that Bob did misappropriate funds for the jet ski. They fine him $50,000 and suspend him for 6 months.
Ouch.
Yeah. He receives the written decision in the mail. Now he wants to appeal. The first step of appeal goes to the National Adjudicatory Council, or the NAC.
Okay, listener, direct question time again. If you're taking the exam, what's your first instinct here? Bob loses. He gets the written decision in the mail on a Tuesday. He stews on it. He argues with his lawyer, and he finally waits 26 days to file an appeal to the NAC. A normal person thinks, 26 days, that's close enough, right within a month. What actually happens to Bob's appeal?
What do you think happens?
Take a guess.
His appeal is flatly rejected.
Rejected entirely.
Entirely. The window to appeal to the NAC is exactly 25 days from the service of the decision, not 30 days. 25. Deadlines in the Code of Procedure are fatal. If you miss the 25-day window, your right to appeal is gone and the sanctions stick.
25 days, got it. That is such a random number, but you have to memorize it. But let's say he files on day 20. He's safe.
Okay.
But here is the biggest exam trap in this entire section. Mm-hmm. Appealing to the NAC is a massive two-sided risk. It is not a free roll of the dice. Why is it so dangerous to appeal?
This is critical to understand. In a normal civil court system, if you appeal a $50,000 fine, the appellate court might uphold it, or they might take pity and lower it to $25,000.
Right. It can only get better or stay the same.
Exactly. But under FINRA rules, the NAC has the power to affirm, reduce, or increase the sanctions.
Wait, they can make it worse?
Much worse. If Bob appeals complaining about a $50,000 fine and a six-month suspension, the NAC might review the record and say, you know what? The hearing panel was too lenient. This jet ski theft was egregious. We are bumping the fine to $100,000 and barring you permanently.
Talk about a backfire. You complain to the manager and the manager fires you. But why would FINRA design it that way?
It's a deterrent mechanism. FINRA doesn't want guilty reps clogging up the system by frivolously appealing every single guilty verdict just to delay paying their fines. The threat of increased sanctions forces reps to only appeal if they truly believe a severe legal error was made.
That makes perfect, terrifying sense. So Bob appeals to the NAC, and let's say they uphold the panel's decision. What is the rest of the chain of command? Where does he go next?
From the NAC, the FINRA Board of Governors has a discretionary right to review it, but Bob can't force them to take the case. Assuming they pass, his next right of appeal takes him outside of FINRA entirely. He appeals up to the SEC.
Exam trap alert. When Bob gets to the SEC, I imagine he can just dump a new box of receipts on their desk and demand a totally new trial, right? Because they're a government agency.
Nope, absolute opposite. When it goes to the SEC, it is a record review only, not a de novo hearing.
De novo meaning starting fresh.
Right. The SEC does not start fresh. Think of it like a referee watching a video replay in a sports game. You can't bring a new player onto the field during the video review.
Ah, good analogy.
The SEC only looks at the exact written transcript and the specific evidence that was presented to the original FINRA hearing panel.
So, if Bob suddenly finds a receipt proving he paid for the jet ski with his own cash, but he didn't submit it during the original FINRA hearing, the SEC will refuse to look at it.
Exactly. You cannot bring in new evidence on appeal.
And if he loses at the SEC, his final stop is the real world, the U.S. Court of Appeals. But let's pause here. We need to reset the board. This entire code of procedure track we just walked through. Enforcement, the hearing panel, the NAC, the SEC. This is all the criminal court side of our DUI analogy. This is all about Bob's license to operate and his fines paid to the regulator. Customer Carl does not care about any of that.
Not at all.
Yeah.
FINRA enforcement doesn't write restitution checks to customers. Enforcement's job is public protection. Carl is sitting at home staring at an empty driveway where his bright yellow jet ski should be, and he just wants his $48,000 back.
So to get his money, Carl has to use a completely different system. We leave the Code of Procedure, and we enter the civil court equivalent, which is the Code of Arbitration.
This is where we clearly see the difference between regulatory discipline and private dispute resolution. Arbitration is simply private parties fighting over money. And FINRA actually has two parallel codes for this, the Customer Code and the Industry Code.
So a direct comparison of those two, because the exam loves testing the asymmetry here. Let's start with the Customer Code. It is heavily asymmetric, right?
Deeply asymmetric. Under the Customer Code, Customer Carl has a unilateral right to force Broker Bob and Firm Fiona into FINRA arbitration, even if Carl never signed a pre-dispute arbitration agreement when he opened his account.
Wow.
Yeah. The moment Carl demands FINRA arbitration to get his jet ski money, the firm must comply.
But the reverse is not true, is it? Broker Bob cannot force Customer Carl into arbitration unless Carl actually signed a written contract agreeing to it beforehand. Carl holds all the power when it comes to choosing the battlefield.
That's the Customer Code. The Industry Code, on the other hand, is the rule book for disputes between insiders. It is mandatory for disputes between members and reps. For example, if firm Fiona wants to sue broker Bob because he left the firm and defaulted on a massive upfront signing bonus, or if Bob wants to sue Fiona because she wrote something nasty and defamatory on his Form U5 exit ticket, they must use FINRA arbitration. They cannot go to state court.
And here is a massive exam trap regarding the industry code. Let's say firm Fiona is sick of FINRA arbitrations. They are expensive, they're annoying. So in Bob's initial employment contract, she sneaks in a clause that says any employment disputes between the firm and the broker will be handled in a local state court or through the American Arbitration Association, not FINRA. Can she do that?
No, she cannot. Pre-dispute waivers for the industry code are strictly illegal. Period. Yeah. They are a violation of FINRA rules. A firm cannot force a rep to waive their right to the FINRA Industry Arbitration Forum in advance. FINRA wants to keep industry disputes in-house.
Okay, let's go back to Carl. Carl wants his money. Let's talk about simplified arbitration, which is FINRA's fast-track process for smaller claims. Listener direct question. Carl is demanding $48,000 for the stolen funds, plus he wants $5,000 in interest because this whole ordeal has been dragging on for a year. Does he qualify for simplified arbitration? Give it some thought.
Is it under the limit?
Okay, got your answer.
Yes, he does qualify. The threshold for simplified arbitration is claims of $50,000 or less, exclusive of interest and expenses.
Oh.
So when you are calculating the threshold, you ignore the interest. You only look at the base damage claim, which is $30,000. Mm-hmm. He is under the $50,000 limit.
And what exactly makes it simplified? How is it different from normal arbitration?
It's simplified because one single public arbitrator decides the entire case based purely on written pleadings. There is no trial.
Oh.
There is no in-person hearing. There is no witness testimony or cross-examination. You just mail in your arguments and your evidence, and the arbitrator makes a binding decision based on the paper.
Unless
customer Carl requests a hearing. Under the customer code, the customer retains the unilateral right to demand an in-person hearing, even in a simplified arbitration.
So he still has the power.
Right. If Carl really wants his day in court to physically point his finger and yell at Bob, he gets it. But crucially, firm Fiona and broker Bob do not have the right to demand a hearing. They are entirely at the mercy of Carl's choice.
Again, asymmetry favoring the customer. What about default proceedings in arbitration? Let's say firm Fiona's company went completely bankrupt from all these lawsuits and has been expelled from FINRA. The firm doesn't even bother answering Carl's arbitration claim. Does the arbitrator just look at Carl and say, well, the firm didn't show up. Here is a default judgment for $48,000. Enjoy your jet ski money.
No, and that is a very important nuance. Even if the firm is expelled or suspended and defaults on the claim, the arbitrator cannot issue an award based solely on their non-appearance.
Really?
Yeah. Carl still has to prove his case on paper. He has to submit sufficient evidence to prove Bob actually stole the money.
That makes sense. You can't just invent a fake claim against a dead firm and get a guaranteed payout. Okay, what if Bob and Carl are both exhausted, the lawyers are racking up billable hours, the paperwork is a mile high, and they just want to sit in a room and hash it out like adults? This brings us to mediation, the voluntary alternative.
Mediation operates alongside arbitration, but its mechanics are fundamentally different. There are three pillars of mediation you must memorize for the exam. First, it is strictly voluntary. Nobody can be forced into mediation. It requires a signed submission agreement from all parties. Second, the mediator cannot force a decision.
Right. An arbitrator imposes a binding judgment like a judge, but a mediator just facilitates a conversation. They are basically a highly paid therapist for financial disputes.
Exactly. Only the parties can agree to actually settle. And the third pillar is confidentiality. Everything said or any document prepared specifically for the mediation session is strictly confidential. It cannot be used later in the arbitration if the mediation fails.
So if Bob has a moment of weakness in mediation and admits, okay, maybe I did accidentally commingle some funds, but I didn't mean to steal them, Carl cannot use that confession as a weapon in the arbitration later on. The confidentiality is what allows them to be honest and actually try to reach a settlement.
Correct. But here is the exam trap.
Yes, this one is huge.
Does going into mediation automatically pause the ticking clock of the arbitration?
This trips up so many people. What is the answer?
The answer is no. Unless the parties expressly agree in writing to a mediation stay, all the arbitration deadlines, the discovery requests, the motion practice, the hearing dates, they all keep running concurrently.
So you could just time out.
Yes. If Bob assumes the arbitration is on pause just because they're sitting in the mediation room, he might miss a critical filing deadline and lose the entire arbitration by default.
So always get the stay in writing. All right, let's move to our final act, the scrub down. Plot twist time. In the arbitration discovery process, the lawyers dig deep, and it is revealed that customer Carl actually did buy the jet ski himself.
Unbelievable.
Right. He bought it with his options premium money, he crashed it into a dock, panicked because he didn't have insurance, and he expertly framed broker Bob to cover his tracks and try to extort a settlement.
Classic Carl. Just menace.
Total menace.
Yep.
So Bob obviously wins the arbitration. The arbitrator rules entirely in Bob's favor. But here is the lingering nightmare. Because Carl made that initial written complaint alleging theft, that severe allegation is now a permanent stain on Bob's broker check CRD record, the Central Registration Depository.
Yeah.
Every time a prospective new client Googles Bob, they see, accused of misappropriating funds for a jet ski, how does Bob delete it? This process is called expungement.
And it is incredibly difficult. Feneron treats the CRD system like a sacred text. You cannot just call up Feneron's IT department, say, hey, I won the arbitration, here's my ticket, and ask them to hit the delete key. They will not do it.
Why not? If he's innocent, just delete it.
Well, expungement is intentionally narrow and procedurally demanding because Feneron is trying to protect the integrity of a national database. If every rep could easily delete bad reviews, the database would be useless to the public. So Bob needs to fulfill a strict two-step requirement.
So if he can't just email Feneron, does he have to sue them? What are the two steps?
Step one, he needs an arbitration award that explicitly grants expungement relief.
Okay.
Step two, he must take that arbitration award to a court of competent jurisdiction, a real civil judge in a real court, and get the award concerned into a formal court order. One without the other is completely useless.
So an arbitration award without a court confirmation does nothing.
Exactly. And a court order without the underlying arbitration findings is insufficient. Yeah. It is a two-key lock.
And when he goes to that real civil court, who is he actually suing? Is he suing Carl?
He is actually required to name Feneron as a party in the court confirmation process. He must serve Feneron with the legal documents unless Feneron explicitly reviews the case and waives that requirement.
Oh, why Feneron?
Feneron wants the chance to show up in court and object if they think a dirty broker is trying to scrub legitimate, dangerous disciplinary history from the public eye.
Okay, so step one was getting the arbitrator to grant the expungement in the first place. But the arbitrator can't just grant it because they feel bad for Bob's ruined reputation, right? There are very specific standards they have to meet.
Yes. Listener, here is your final question.
Put your thinking caps on.
The arbitrator looks at the evidence, realizes Carl is a liar, rules that Carl's claim, quote, lacked merit, and dismisses the case. Is the phrase lacked merit enough to legally get the record expunged?
Take a beat. Is it enough?
No, it is not. The exam will try to trick you with soft phrases like lacked merit or dismissed. Feneron requires the arbitrator to affirmatively find one of three strict substantive standards.
Because again, Feneron wants maximum transparency. What are the three magic boxes the arbitrator can check?
Standard one, the claim is factually impossible or clearly erroneous.
Okay. Give me an example of that.
For example, if Carl claimed Bob made the bad trades in 2022, but Bob didn't even work at the firm until 2023, it is physically impossible.
Factually impossible. Got it. What's the second standard?
Standard two, the rep was not involved in the specific alleged violation. This is an objective non-involvement standard.
Okay.
The arbitrator must find that a violation might have occurred, but Bob had absolutely nothing to do with it. Maybe another broker at the firm did it, but Bob's name was just on the master account.
And the third?
Standard three. The claim, allegation, or information is completely false. The arbitrator finds that Carl simply fabricated the whole thing out of thin air.
Which is what happened with the jet ski.
Exactly. The arbitrator must explicitly check one of those three specific boxes in their written award. Factually impossible, not involved, or completely false.
So Bob gets the arbitrator to rule that the claim was completely false. He takes that award to a real judge, names Feneron as a party. The judge confirms it into an order, and Feneron finally scrubs the CRD record. The jet ski nightmare is gone. But let's throw in one last exam trap. Let's imagine a slightly different timeline. What if Bob, before finding out Carl was lying, panicked under the pressure and paid Carl a $10,000 settlement just to make the tweets stop? Months later, the truth comes out about the dot crash, and Bob successfully goes through the two-step expungement process. Does the expungement force Carl to give the $10,000 back?
No, it absolutely does not. Expungement only erases the CRD entry. It only fixes the public record.
So he's out the money.
He is. It does not unwind a financial settlement, and it does not invalidate an underlying arbitration award. If you paid the money to settle, the money is gone.
So expungement is PR repair, not a refund.
Exactly. Also, expungement only applies to customer dispute information. This goes back to our DUI analogy.
Oh, right.
If FINRA enforcement had fined Bob $5,000 in code of procedure for a separate bookkeeping error during this whole mess, he cannot expunge that regulatory disciplinary finding. You can only scrub the neighbor's civil dispute, not the state's penalty.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today, from the first angry tweet to the final scrub of the public record. It is time for our rapid-fire recap. We are going to trade off the most highly testable facts from this entire deep dive so they stick in your brain. Ready?
Ready, let's do it.
OSJ written customer complaints. You must keep them for 4 years. This beats the SEC's 3-year rule because FINRA's exam cycle is 4 years. The stricter rule always wins.
30-day per event reports.
Yeah.
Triggered by immediate threats like theft or forgery allegations, statutory DQs, and settlements over $15,000 for a rep or $25,000 for a firm, the initial demand size doesn't matter.
Quarterly reports. Due on the 15th of the month following the quarter. They are a statistical dragnet that covers all written customer complaints, even the catastrophic ones you already reported on the 30-day flare.
Investigations. FINRA has a 2-year jurisdictional tail over former reps, starting from their U5 termination date. And refusing to answer an information request for 90 days results in a permanent bar because cooperation is the foundation of the system.
Code of procedure, the internal criminal court. The hearing panel is one FINRA lawyer for procedure and two industry peers for market norms. You have exactly 25 days to appeal to the NAC. And beware the trap. The NAC can increase your sanctions to punish frivolous appeals.
The SEC appeal above the NAC is a record review only. No new evidence is allowed on the field.
Arbitration, the civil court. Customers can compel arbitration unilaterally without a contract. Reps cannot. Pre-dispute waivers for industry disputes are illegal. Simplified arbitration is for claims of $50,000 or less, ignoring interest, and it's a paper-only process unless the customer specifically demands a hearing.
Mediation. Voluntary, next binding, and confidential. But it does not pause the arbitration clock unless you get a written stay.
And finally, expungement. It's a 2-key lock. It requires both an arbitration award explicitly granting it and a civil court confirmation. The arbitrator must find the claim was factually impossible, the rep was not involved, or the claim was completely false. It does not get your settlement money back.
Boom. Yeah. That is the complete life cycle of a dispute.
So what does this all mean for the test taker? We always like to leave you with something to ponder that builds on everything we just discussed to give you a framework for guessing when you're stuck on a question.
Think about the entire FINRA system we just mapped out. It is built on an incredible, highly intentional asymmetry. A customer can unilaterally force a broker into a private arbitration without a contract, but a broker can't do the same to a customer.
Right.
A broker is compelled to hand over their personal bank records without a constitutional subpoena just to keep their job. The system makes expungement incredibly difficult to achieve. This entire ecosystem heavily tilts toward investor protection and regulatory transparency, prioritizing the public over industry convenience.
So if you're taking the Series 24... and you hit a question where you completely blanked on the rule. Wait, I mean, if you forget the rule entirely.
If you have to guess, ask yourself which answer offers the most protection to customer Carl and which answer provides the most transparency to the regulator. That intuition, understanding why the rules exist, will usually guide you to the correct answer.
It's so true. We started this deep dive talking about the DUI analogy, the state taking your license versus the neighbor suing for the fence. The rules we covered today, the 4 years, the 30 days, the 15,000 thresholds, that is, fate and era, trying to build a rigid machine to manage messy human behavior. It's never going to be perfectly clean because people like customer Carl and broker Bob are fundamentally chaotic. But if you understand why the machine is built the way it is, you won't just memorize facts to pass the exam. You'll actually understand how to survive the industry. Thanks for diving in with us.